The Sunstone Theological Society presents Third World Sisters, Issues of LDS Women in Development, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
And we're going to do the panel on Third World Sisters. First of all, as it turns out, I'm going to be both a moderator and a panelist, and I hope that kind of sets the tone for the informal kind of discussion we'd like to have. We're not here to give definitive answers. We'd like to raise, hopefully, some questions and some issues you might not have thought very much about. First of all, I'd like each of us to introduce ourselves, but rather than give the traditional credentials that normally go with academic settings, I would like each of the panelists to say what qualities they have that would be appreciated by Third World Sisters, and perhaps what pertinent background, and that is to exclude degrees. And I will just start by saying that I think what the Third World women that I have worked with, and a lot of those being Native American, whom I consider to be Third World women, appreciate in me is my ability to listen, to understand, to empathize, and to an extent, to become one, if temporarily, with those sisters.
This is Krista Robinson, and I agree with Bonnie. I feel that one of the main qualities I possess that the women of Latin America seem to be drawn to me is that ability to listen and to empathize with their struggles and their desire to better themselves and to do the best that they can do.
My name is Tricia Ormsby, and I think one of the things that Third World women like about me is that I can help them carry their stuff to market, make tortillas, and stir-fry rice.
Well, considering the fact that I'm the only male panelist, I don't think I should say what the Third World women like about me. particularly when you consider that gender ratios closely approach those of Mormonism among Mormon Third World women. I grew up in the Third World on the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas and in New Mexico, and we don't usually think of that as Third World, but it is. And I've lived in South America for a long time. And so in some senses, I guess what I bring to this is that I am from the Third World to a degree as well as from the First World, and I hope to bring that interaction to play.
Now what we'll do is each of us will take 5 to 10 minutes to identify what we see as being two or three crucial issues for LDS women in developing countries. And we're going to start with Tricia because she's going to give us a little bit of demographic data about women in the church generally and then move quickly into the specific experiences that each one of us have had.
We'd like to start this by setting the stage and getting an idea of how many women we're talking about and where they are. Two-thirds of our church membership right now is in the United States, but with the growth patterns of the church, probably you've even heard of this already today, we have a lot more growth taking place outside the U.S. And we now have about 6.4 million members of the church, of which 1 million are in South America, 500,000 in Central America, Mexico, and then smaller numbers in other places. And as of right now, we're starting a lot of growth in the church in third world countries. For example, in 87, that was when the Zaire mission was open. There are missionaries in Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Zimbabwe, the British Islands of Africa, Kenya, Ivory Coast, Liberia, Mauritius, Sierra Leone, La Reunion, Guinea. Also, the PRC has started to have not necessarily missionaries, but there is missionary couples are allowed to go in there now. Also, there's interest in the church in Burma and in some activity in the church in India, too. So a lot of these, the new places that the church is opening up are definitely third world countries and some of the countries where there are some of the most difficult living conditions. Now, I was trying to figure out for this talk actually how many women we are talking about as far as third world LDS women. So I talked to the people that keep the statistics in the church office building and found out that there really aren't statistics on this. And so we figured it out by counting and taking Relief Society rolls and that sort of thing. And it came out to about 600,000 of our Relief Society sisters are living in developing countries. And so that is approximately of the 2.3 million members in Relief Society, that's approximately a quarter of our Relief Society members are in third world areas. So this is really a large number, I think, of the sisters in the church who are facing daily all the problems that women face in third world developing countries. A daily event is finding enough resources, getting it together to feed, clothe, and shelter their families, themselves and their families. There are some, even though each area differs culturally, and with the resource base differs in each country, there's a real predictable pattern of the kinds of challenges that third world women face. There's a self-perpetuating cycle of having poor health and then not being able to work and then not being able, by not being able to work, meaning to get cash or work agriculturally, then they're behind even further. And so they have poor health and overall lowered potential for their lives. It's really a difficult daily kind of a task. Now, generally, the problems that are faced by third world women include, one, limited resources. And these limited resources, a big one in that is personal time. Generally, third world women work very, very hard. They get up early in the morning. They start to do whatever their daily task is. For some, it's preparing food right off for the family. For others, it's taking care of animals or going out and doing something agricultural or even getting on the bus so they can get to market so they can start selling things in order to get some money for their family. There's a whole lot of activities that they do, but basically, women in these situations work very, very hard, and their time is, you know, we sometimes think we're stressed with time and that sort of thing here in this culture, but I think nothing in comparison to the way that the sisters are stressed in third world areas. They really have to keep that kind of a pattern up every day in order to keep their families together in many cases. They really have to work hard. This leads to, one of the particular things that leads to, it deals with health, and that is there's a condition called maternal depletion. And this is where women start bearing children very young, and in many cases, especially these African countries that the church is going into now, a lot of the women are men, they're 14 or 15 and have five or six children by the time they're 25. And so maternal depletion starts when women start bearing children very early and don't have many breaks in between the children. And they just get worn out physically by the kind of activity and schedules that they have, and plus having children to either be bearing or nursing while they're doing all these other things. And so together they really, it takes a toll on these women's health and their whole system and livelihood. Okay, another thing that is a limited resource in many areas of the world is money. Now, one of the things that, you know, that makes sense to us, we, I think, have all experienced that becomes a limited resource to us, but one of the things that's happened in the third world now, one of the trends is that a lot of the subsistence economies that were very prevalent in that people could raise food and then almost exchange it for the things that they need and that sort of thing and deal with goods, has changed to a cash economy. So cash is becoming a very important thing in order to get what people need. And so women are becoming forced to go into the kind of things that will earn them cash so they can get medicine and other things for their family. And this is difficult because a lot of the women aren't trained or let into the circles where they can get some money to buy the things that they need for their family. So this is another area of limited resources, things that they need. Education. Now, education is becoming somewhat of a brighter picture. Right now in the world, about 80% of the women have access to education and could go if the resources they have allow it. In other words, does the family have enough money to buy the books so that the girl can go to school? Or is there enough money so that the girl doesn't have to stay home and work for the family to sustain the family? Is there enough flexibility there so that she can actually use the public schools that are there for her? Okay, so that's becoming a little bit better. All right, and now we have, this is just a real brief picture of some of the challenges that women face in the third world. very brief, but what I'd like to do is for a minute here try to integrate what are some of the responsibilities and rewards of church membership integrated in with these kind of situations that third world women find themselves. So we have certain expectations as members of the church. One is attendance at church meetings. Okay, that's a fairly basic kind of thing. And then we look at what kind of resources do these women have and their families have in order to meet that. One is cost of transportation. I have known several families that just couldn't all make it to church on a given Sunday because they all couldn't afford the bus fare to get there. And they had to make choices as to who was going to go to church. And sometimes it was an easy choice. It was the healthy one went to church, and and everyone else kind of rested at home. But that's, you know, that's in the long run, that's not the way things should be. You know, there should be enough opportunity for everyone to be able to go. Okay, then they get to church and they have lessons. Okay, one of the things with lessons is that somebody has to prepare them. I've known several branches where the person who was always a teacher was the one who could read. Okay, the one who could read the manual was the one who would teach the lesson. So sometimes you got the same person for Relief Society, for Sunday school, and everything else. So that's one of the things that is an important factor in this whole education process, is that there is a need for reading in the way the church is set up. Now, I did read a real interesting study once where they did it. It was in Latin America, where they compared a group of Catholic people with some, they call them Protestant people, but in the footnotes it said these were Mormons. And the thing they found different about Mormons and Catholics was, even though they all started on the same plane, the Mormons had all joined the church, you know, within a fairly recent amount of time, and they found that the Mormons were reading. And the reason why they were reading and they were also learning how to do math. And the reason why is because they wanted to read their scriptures, and a fair number of people were called to be the secretaries or the ward clerks, and they needed to know how to deal with numbers. And so they had an additional encouragement there to read. And so that was, I thought that was a real interesting kind of an observation of how people can change and what some of the motivations are. Okay, now getting with these lessons, well, I think one of the challenges for third world women are to be able to glean things that are helpful to them through these lessons. And I was, as I was thinking about being on this panel, I was asking several friends who had worked with on developing countries, and particularly the African countries, which this is a new place for us, and to see how the gospel was fitting into their culture. And one woman was telling me she was sitting in a Relief Society lesson in Eket in Nigeria, and it was a lesson on decision making, and she's talking about, you know, how we all need to make decisions, and one of the African women raised her hands, "What do you mean by making a decision?" And so the explanation was given, well, when you get up in the morning, you decide what you're going to do that day. And the African woman still looked really puzzled, and they, you know, she kind of, there was some talk back and forth about, you know, how you have to decide whether you want to do this or this. And finally, the African woman just said, well, for us, there is no choice. We get up. We have to make food for our family. And, you know, there were no options. There was no leeway, you know. And so I thought that was a real interesting little exchange there. Luckily, the African woman wasn't offended at all. She just thought, well, that's curious that Americans have to think about what they're going to do. You know, we know what we're going to do because it's basically the same every day, and we have to do that to keep our families going. So there are, I think there's some room for cultural sensitivity there with our lessons to make sure that these things really do apply. There is also, along with that, that I think we have transported some of our culture across with our lessons also. And people with all kinds of well-meaning plans have done things like taught people in very hot countries how to quilt, make quiet books for their children when, you know, their children weren't even in church, you know, different things like that, you know. Bake biscuits when they don't use wheat as a, you know, they can't find any wheat anywhere, but they want to learn, teach them how to make biscuits. I think generally, in most cases, it's been accepted as a, that's the way Americans do it, and we'll go about doing our own thing. Okay, another expectation, which goes along with what I said before about reading the scriptures, is do they know how to read? Okay, and that, like I said, is we do have some encouragement there to learn to be literate. Okay, temple attendance, I think, is another big one. I have been in several places where people sacrificed a lot to go to the temple, and have come back very much encouraged and happy that they went. They really was a good experience for them. But then there are some other situations, too, that follow through with that I think sometimes we don't think about, and that is when all the women go down to the stream and wash their clothes together in the morning. I don't know if any of you have been in a country where they do that, or been on the bus going someplace and you pass all these streams and all the women are out there and it's a big social event and everybody's, having fun and the kids are splashing water on each other. that it becomes a difficulty sometimes for people that have gone to the temple. What do you do with the garments? I mean, everybody wears the same clothes there, and it's kind of a difficult thing for them. And also the cost of them. The cost of the garments is a difficult thing for many people to bear, especially when they have a lot of people in their family and they're expensive. Okay, along with the idea of the cash economy that we talked about before is the idea of tithing. Where do we get the money to pay the tithing with, especially if they're dealing with basically with maybe a subsistence kind of economy and they're trading with other people for what they need? How do they get that? Fast offerings also. I read a really encouraging, in fact, this is a really delightful plan that they came up with in the Philippines on fast offering. Is called a handful of rice, and it's where instead of giving money for fast offerings, I forget who it was that came up with it, but instead of giving money, they each family saved a handful of rice, and they brought it on Sunday and collected it, and then they gave it out to the families that were needing food. But also the families that needed food were supposed to take a handful of rice. So from what they got, they took a handful of rice, too, and kept that as something that they could give. And it changed from something like 35 families needing assistance down to 2. So it really did help. It was a way of helping those families that were in need at certain times and really helped to encourage all the members of that ward to work together and to really support each other in that. So I think that that's a good example of how things were worked so that it fit with the situation, the economic situation. Now, one thing I'd like to talk about here is the end of my 5 minutes. I think I've already gone over. Is aspirations of third world women in the church. We collected some information last summer in Bolivia from LDS women in rural areas of La Paz. And one of the questions we asked is, if you could get what you most want from life, what would it be? Okay, and these were some of the reactions that they had. I hope that my husband can get a new job and earn a better salary so I can dedicate myself exclusively to education and bring up my children. I don't want them to someday reject me and tell me I was not a good mother. One was to get a raise. In the company, they speak of getting raises because the cost of living has gone up every few months. Next one was to change work and get a better salary and be able to give my daughter an important profession so she can defend herself and her life. But that was a real interesting way of talking about life, defend herself in this life. That someday my husband can change his very, very macho form and help me in the education of our children, which is not only a mother's work but should be the work of both husband and wife. Another woman hoped that things in the country would get better and the economic reactivation, which our politicians always talk about so much, be enacted. Another woman said, to obtain another work that pays better with a schedule that will be only half a day so I can have free time to attend to my children. So there are a lot of, I thought it was interesting that a lot of these women, that the way they wanted to better their life, and some of the aspirations they had were so tied to things dealing with sustaining daily life. It really is a constant thing on their mind, and I think much more than those of us in the church that have been raised in areas where there is opportunity to have work and to have enough income to sustain what we need. And then we can think about other things. A lot of these women on a daily basis are thinking about, how am I going to sustain life? How am I going to make it through today? In fact, one of the most touching things out of that survey was, one of the questions was, had it been a good day, and the day before? And she said that one woman responded, "Oh, yes, it was a wonderful day. The Relief Society sisters came and brought a loaf of bread so I could feed my children." And I thought that was really touching, and showing how that daily life really is a day-by-day thing, that they'll make it through and be happy through each day. I think one of the things that the church can add to the lives of these third world women is a hope that things can change, and the idea that life can be good and be very good. And some of the things, like in Mosiah 2:41, consider on the blessed and happy state of those that keep the commandments of God. For behold, they are blessed in all things, both temporal and spiritual. And I think that is one of the things that I hope most for a lot of our third world sisters, is that they can stay faithful and get those kind of blessings. They come both with the Lord's blessings, I think, and a lot of work on the part of other people to help where they can and to make improvements where they can. Thank you.
What I will speak briefly on is, I spent all of my time in Latin America, and I will only make my comments referring to that area of the world. And I would like to make it rather personalized and speak from my personal experience with women and sisters in the church. My main concern I have with Latin American sisters is that we often in the church have the superiority of being from the United States, believing that we know everything. We have the true gospel. We have this great message for them to receive. But we also assume we have the true culture. And what we need to solve their problems is not only the gospel, but other things in their lives. And I think it's a presupposition that is not necessarily true and does not help them. I think we assume that the stories of Mary Fielding Smith and Eliza R. Snow are role models for womanhood that sometimes are not understood by these same women, that their experiences are different, their problems are different, and they just do not understand why they should follow that certain type of genre. Latin America is filled with incredible women that have fought for freedom in many different lands, have pioneered in many ways in diverse climates and areas. And I think that we should encourage our Latin American sisters to recognize the great wealth of history and majesty that these women have had in the past. Far before there were ever pilgrims on our shores here, there were women fighting for to survive and saved expeditions in South America. With the superiority, I'd like to give one example. I had the opportunity to serve my mission in Maracaibo, Venezuela, and I happened to be able to return and speak to my mission presidents, not as a missionary, which you find out all sorts of neat things that you never knew before. But I was speaking to the mission president's wife, and she was expressing some of the frustrations that she felt. And she's from Colombia and then had married an Ecuadorian and had been living in Quito. And some of the frustrations she felt as the showing an album of her home in Quito to assistant to the president, an elder, and he was absolutely shocked that her home had a carpet, that there were chandeliers in her home, that she had everything that we had in the United States. he had assumed that because they were mission presidents and living in the missionary home, that they were living far beyond that they ever had known before. That's an attitude that is rampant throughout all the missionaries. They assume that their native companions are experiencing a time in their life that they never will before, that they're in an apartment that was never like the apartment, the home they had in their growing up. And this attitude that we don't have these things, but Latin American women do, and some do not. Also, I was able to spend time in Venezuela on the border of Colombia with the Guajiro Indians. And it's a matrilineal society. Women are in charge of many of the rituals, and they are in charge of the burials and any type of ritual. They are head of this. The church has not gone out into these areas. It's very out in the boondocks. But there are quite a few Guajiro women urbanized in the city, and urbanization and modernization has changed greatly their culture and such. But some have joined the church, and I had the opportunity to live with a Guajiro family. And I remember many occasions in this particular family, the father and the brothers were taxi drivers, and they would collect the fares throughout the day, and when they would come, they would immediately go and put all the money in their mother's lap. And she would divide out the tithing, and then from there she would divide out where the money went. And that she was the head of the household in many aspects. She decided where the money went and where things, you know, when and who went to school and different things like that. And that often seems to clash hard against the patriarchal type of authority with the priesthood, and having men, white men or mestizos men, telling her what she should do. And that has been a hard struggle for her and many of her Guajiro sisters. And we assume that our way is the best, and not realizing that there's just many different ways to handle the same situation. Another common occurrence that occurred, I saw quite a bit of, was that many of the manuals and lessons, plans, it's a wonderful thing that we have them translate into Spanish, and they have these resource material. But I would say 100% of them are translated directly from the English version. Same stories, same songs that we would sing. In this particular instance, Ana Gonzalez, an 18-year-old, was primary president, struggling to go to school and do her church responsibilities at the same time and help her mother at home. Well, I was preparing a lesson, and there was a short verses, and it asked for her to sing the song, for the children to sing it. And it had no music along, and it just had words. And, of course, we would know what the tune was, but they had no idea. But that didn't stop her. She said, "I just made up a tune and sang the song." And so it shows that they're resourceful, and they keep and doing what they need to be doing. But I think that we can help along and help them through their trials. I think we need to remember the example in the Book of Mormon when Nephi had to explain the words of Isaiah to the Nephites. They didn't understand what Isaiah was saying. It was said in the words of the Jews, in the tradition of the Jews in Jerusalem. And they just didn't seem to, they couldn't understand it. And we don't, personally, I don't understand much of it. But when Nephi explained it to them, they said, "Oh, so this is what this means." And I think we need to do that same sort of translating to them. My final concern is we often talk about President Benson's talk of two women. And we obviously know that he wasn't speaking to third world women, that the working is not done for luxuries, for music lessons for Johnny or a new sweater for Susie, that they're working for the necessities of life and for the opportunity to just go to school and to they have to buy all their school supplies. It's not supplied at school like it is here in the United States. And we have to recognize that circumstances are different. Another concern that I have that this past semester I wrote a paper on working mothers in Bolivia, and I specifically wrote all the church the presiding bishopric's office and any address that I could get to, and the most receptive was the Relief Society, and they were very helpful, called down to Bolivia for me for many statistics, and they also sent me a short let me read the title of it. It was a pamphlet, a little booklet called An In-Depth Interview Study of the Welfare Needs of LDS Women in Outlying Areas of the World. And it was presented by Jackie A. Smith and Joy F. Evans. And I compliment them on their desire to find out what third world women in outlying areas women are doing. But I was also very disappointed that this whole presentation was based on interviews with returned sister missionaries, welfare missionaries, over the telephone, asking them what they thought was the most, what they thought the women in their areas needed. And from personal experience, I know as a returned sister missionary that I didn't really understand what the women needed at the time. Through study and through other circumstances, I've been able to realize the magnitude of the problems. And I think that there needs to be greater realization of what the problems involve. And there are no easy answers, and it's going to take a long time to help. But the sisters in Latin America are willing to try, and they're willing to do their best. Thank you.
I'm going to speak primarily from my experiences working with Native Americans, and those have been primarily Navajo. I have three things that I want to talk about. One is identity, the second is culture, and the third is marriage. And the first thing that I want to say is that to most Native American women that I have interacted with, their primary issue is survival, and it dovetails very well with what the primary issues are for women in the third world. And it's the survival of my people. And when they identify my people, they're not talking about Indian. They're talking about their tribe. And they are distinct, and I guess I get a little bit defensive when people talk about the Indians as if they're all the same, because they're not. Their issues are distinct related to their tribes, and their issues are more Indian than they are women's issues for the most part. And some of those issues would be problems like the infant mortality rate, the life expectancy. Those statistics for reservations are very parallel, very similar to those for third world countries. Suicide, very high, alcoholism, tremendous problem. So I think their issues are Indian issues more than women's issues, and tribal issues more than Indian issues. The second issue is culture, and I think the heart-rending problem that I see that is faced every day is, when I join the church, what must be left behind? And the thing that is heart-rending for me is what is left behind that, in my feeling, does not need to be left behind. But there is a perception that I want to do everything the way the missionaries do it, and so I will leave everything behind and become just like the missionaries or the other members of the church. George P. Lee's autobiography kind of highlights this, and he perceived his choice between becoming a medicine man and being trained as his father was versus, I think he was working on his PhD, getting a formal education in an institutional setting. And for me, the sorrow is that he didn't do both. And I think it's possible. There are all sorts of things that are a vital part of Native American, sort of pan-Indian culture at this point, some of those being powwows, sweat lodges, medicine wheels. when BYU first had their powwow, they didn't call it a powwow. They couldn't. They weren't allowed to. That's heathen. A sweat lodge. If you're familiar with Enos and the, it seems like sort of stages of prayer that he goes through. He prays for himself to purify himself. Then he prays for his family and those that are related. Then he prays for his enemies, and that's about the end of it. I was lucky enough to participate in the sweat lodge once, and they went through those same three stages. And then the fourth stage was, and please bless all of the living creatures on the earth, and bless Mother Earth, because she needs our help. To me, it was a beautiful way of tying it all together, and sort of a fourth part that to me seemed like it had been missing before. And then there are all sorts of specifics that go with specific Native American heritages that members of the church feel forced to make that kind of choice. Another thing with culture, and I guess this is the point that I want to make, is that in so many of our attempts to be pluralistic, to be open-minded, to be accepting perhaps, it seems as if we want to incorporate a minority group into our organization. And I think the basic flaw is that we assume that we have all of, or most of, or the best part of the truth and whatever there is in life. And it seems crucial to me that to recognize that other peoples with different cultural backgrounds have very important things to contribute that we can learn from. The last issue, being marriage, is one I thought of after we were already started, and that's because I also was in Guatemala for a short time and became very good friends with a single Mormon woman who had been extremely active in the church all of her life, I believe. One of the first, a member of a family that was one of the first converted in Guatemala. And she had been told and counseled that she should marry in the temple. And in Guatemala, as in other third world places, there are a lot more women than there are men in the church. And she heeded that counsel. And then when she was in her early 40s, she was criticized for not having had any children. And the choice between marrying someone outside the church or remaining single can be a very poignant one for women who have strong testimonies of the church. Thank you.
What we're talking about today are perhaps the most forgotten of the forgotten. There's a very rich discourse, a very rich set of literature, of learning, a body of wisdom that Mormon women have developed. If you take a look how many sessions here in Sunstone are devoted to Mormon women, you'll find a fairly large percentage, a very vital sense of understanding of what it means to be a woman is coming out of that scholarship. But what is the social basis of that scholarship? Where does it come from? It's almost totally by those of us who are upper middle class, white, Anglo-Saxons. What do we talk about? Our own experience. What does being a woman, or in my case, a man, mean? What we are and what we do. A substantial percentage of the church membership is composed of people from the third world. There are over 1 million members in Latin America alone. The struggles of that area are totally different than ours. The life experience of those people are totally different than ours. What it means to be a man or a woman is totally different. You cannot talk about the third world as a whole. We have to talk about experience says within Latin America. What it means to be a Guajiro woman is very different than what it means to be a Navajo woman. What it means to be an Argentine Rioplatense, someone from Buenos Aires, is radically different from what it means to be an Aymara Cholita. The difference between a woman from Buenos Aires, from Argentina, and an Indian woman from Bolivia is as great as the difference between the United States. It's greater than the difference between the United States and the Soviet Union. We pretend to share the gospel with these people, but we don't understand these people. We don't know these people. Latin America is very diverse. It's riveted. Third world in general is riveted by class differences. You have a very small dominant class that controls almost everything, and an immense poor working class that goes from what in Latin America passes as middle class, people who struggle but manage to get by, down to peasants. In most cases, the rural population is nears half the population of any given country. Our church does not work, by and large, with the rural people. We have failed in our calling. As Krista pointed out, the church itself knows little about the conditions of these Latin American women. There are a tremendous amount of academic studies. Now, we could go into those here today, and we could talk about what it means economically to be a woman, the struggles that women face when the men are constantly having to migrate to search for labor, the lack of stability in the home. What does it mean in a peasant community, a farming community, when suddenly a woman not only has to raise all the children, she also has to go out and plow the fields, weed the fields, harvest the fields, contract for labor, market the produce, and raise a family? I defy any of us to try that. But that's what development has meant for peasant women in Latin America. Industrial development has sucked the men out of the communities. You walk into peasant communities and it seems like you've gone into a ghetto of women. From my perspective, they're Amazons. It's incredible what they do. But it's a ghetto. We try to form churches there, branches. What do we do with the lack of priesthood? Furthermore, the church is attracting far more women in Latin America than it is men. Women are forgotten not just because we're not studying them, but they're also forgotten because they don't have much of a role in a so totally male-oriented hierarchy and in a church that's so totally oriented towards Anglo-American values or mestizo values. A couple of points that I would like to make, just in general, is that we in Mormonism think that we know what the celestial unit is. We talk about a man and a woman bonding for eternity. And we say that's necessary for salvation. How can that express a clan? What do you do with a matrifocal society? For example, this one charming woman that I met one night in a rainstorm when we were both huddling under the same tree because it was a transport strike and neither of us could get a bus to anywhere in La Paz. And we were talking, and she had a family of children and was raising them. She sold sandwiches on the street. Where was her husband? She kicked him out. He was worthless. He was another mouth to feed, and he couldn't get a job. But she was a brave and noble woman, working very hard. How do we recognize that kind of virtue? And if you think I'm only talking about one example, in the data that Tricia gathered among the working class and poorer women of La Paz, I would venture to say that is more the norm than the exception. If you could read that data, it would make you cry about how women struggle to make a living, to earn $15 a month to feed a family when the minimum wage is supposedly $30. Why do they join the church then with such a struggle? Because the church is another economic resource. The church provides them networks of contacts. It lets them meet upper-class women who might hire them as maids or washerwomen, working women. It's not just spiritual. People are very pragmatic and recognize the strong economic potential. I don't think that the nuclear family is the norm in the third world. This is my own personal opinion, but I don't think it's the norm. And I don't think it's the norm in Latin America. Most families are extended. Children frequently end up being raised by people who are not their biological parents. In fact, children are transferred back and forth. The family is not a man and a wife. It's a household. It's people who come together for well-being over time. We don't focus on the household in our ideology. But women, in many cases, are the dominant ones in the household. Women are the central, at least in my experience in Latin America, are the central distributors of resources. They control the purse. They don't want, you know, in my family, it's not the man who's bringing the money to them, or who controls the money and doles it out for household expenses. They collect the checks from everybody. When I've been living in families, I've been asked point blank to turn over my money for the household good. You have to make that contribution, then it's dispersed. Another point of this is there's tremendous social mobility of daughters. Daughters are a family resource. Education for daughters in these middle classes who are joining the church, the kind of difficult classes, education for daughters is very important. Why? Because sons don't have much chance. Sons are good for labor. So they're sent out to be the brute force of development, the ones who do the industrial work, the laboring work. They're the ones who have very unstable jobs. They're not around. They may have their sons scattered all over the country. Sons suffer tremendous unemployment. When the cycles of capitalism go up and down, the men are suddenly sloughed off, or, you know, and they have nothing to do but go back home to the household and try to survive off other people for the time being, or generate sort of a parallel economy where they can do whatever to get a penny here or a penny there. But women are mobile. They're tremendously mobile. For example, migration from Latin America to the United States is dominated by single women. I don't know if many of you knew that. If you go to the Mormon Spanish-speaking wards here in Salt Lake, you'll find many more single Mormon women who have come to the United States in terms of mobility. Women are much better educated in the church. These kind of women are much better educated than the men around them, but they have little opportunity. They suffer tremendous frustration. We don't address this, but we need to. My feeling is that this panel is a first stab into the darkness. Latin American women, African women, Asian women will not be able to do this themselves, although they have a tremendous tradition of social activism. They could teach us many things. If you've ever stood next to a radical woman who's watched her children be dragged from her feet and shot by the military because they were striking for food, you learn about strength. You learn about sacrifice. You learn lessons that we barely begin to know. But on the other hand, we have resources to dedicate our time to speculation. They don't. We have resources of learning, and from our own experience as Mormons, men and women, that we can contribute to opening a dialogue between us and them, helping them recover their own experience and revitalize it within the church for the benefit of all.
Back to my role as moderator. I've asked each of us to respond to one question, and then you'll be able to ask questions as you would like. The question I would like panel members to respond to has to do with a scripture found in D&C 38, verses 26 and 27. It talks about a man who has sons, and he has clothes one in robes and riches and sets him on this side, and has another one clothes in rags and sets on the other side. And the question is, can such a man say that he is just? And then the injunction that we are given is, I say unto you, be one, and if ye are not one, ye are not mine. And the question I want panel members to respond to is, how can we, as relatively affluent, mostly white, upper middle class, North American sisters primarily, be one with our sisters in developing countries? The one thing that comes to my mind from my experience is sort of an underlying notion of respect, that there must be a respect for difference and a desire to learn from other people, and that when people say, I don't see any differences between black and white or Indian and white or third world and U.S. It makes me a little bit angry. Some things, yes, there are a few that are universal, but in many ways we are different. And how can we know them? I mean, in order to be one, I think we have to know them. And in order to really know them, I think we have to respect that they may see things differently than we do, and we have to be willing to learn to see things as much as we can the way they do, to try and come to where they are, see the way they see, experience the way they experience.
I'm going to speak a little from my family's point of view. I think we didn't have much interest in third world areas until I served a mission and lived it, and that's how I gained my great love. I have to admit it, that it has to be, I have to be knocked over the head before I realize the problems of other people. But it was very interesting to watch my parents. They had the opportunity to come down and pick me up, and not everybody has that opportunity. But I can just remember the absolute amazement on my parents, and particularly my mother's face as we went to the branches that I worked with and went to home evenings with them, and I translated back and forth, and they saw the meals that these poor families would fix for them. I remember particularly my father was quite touched where this young man gave my father it's the size of a silver dollar, but it's a boliviano, and he gave it to my father because of the work I'd done with them, and because he had gained a love for my father in the time he had been there. That absolute love towards my parents that they gave. And since the time that we've been down there, my parents are actively reading about Latin America, and my mother's always, when I come home, "Oh, I've read this book," and she's much more concerned with it. They are now supporting two missionaries on their missions, two sister missionaries, and become quite involved. And I just give this an example. Not everyone has these opportunities, but I think that we can become more aware of the problems and feel what they feel.
I think Bonnie and I were thinking kind of along the same lines. After I wrote down my notes for what I was going to say, I jotted down at the bottom, what can the church add to the lives of third world women, and what can the third world women add to the church? And I think this has a lot to do with the oneness idea that Bonnie was thinking about. I think it's both a collective and an individual issue. Collectively, part of the mission of the church is to preach to all nations, kindreds, tongues, and peoples. And I believe that really is one of the major missions of the church, to go to all the world. And so collectively, as a church, we need to be one in thinking of the people of the world as sons and daughters of God, who need the same kind of opportunities we do in a religious and spiritual sense. And in that way, I think that collectively, as a church, we need to think about other people of the world, and there needs to be some kind of a sense of education and a desire to learn about other people and to break out of our ethnocentric shells that we get in sometimes and think about other people. Now, individually, I think that is a matter that's all up to us. For me, I feel very fortunate because the job that I have takes me out of the country every year, and I have a chance to do one of my favorite things, which is village tromping. I love to go to small towns and areas where I haven't been before, and people are speaking a different language and eating a different food, and kind of get lost in it and learn what they're doing. And I love to sit on buses and strike up a conversation with the woman with her several children and pigs and chickens next to me and find out what she's thinking about. Through this, I have really gained a different perspective about life, and I have found that people who have very few material possessions to be very wise. They have somehow filtered through a lot of the stuff that we get confused with in our culture to get down to the things that are really of essence and of importance. And And I think that that has brought a great deal of strength to me and helped me in my own personal evaluations of what I want to do and what's important. And so in many cases, I do feel, in fact, sometimes I felt more one with the third world sisters I have met in Relief Society and on the street than with some of the women that I meet here. And I think that's been very important to me, and that's how I respond to the question, is that it's both a something that we do because we desire to do it, we desire to know, and something that out of love for and respect for our sisters in the third world.
To be one, we have to know each other, and it's pretty hard to know each other when we speak different languages and when we live far removed. But one way to know each other is to talk to each other through discussion groups such as this. I'm thinking in my mind about when the Savior came to the New World and the society as it's described in the Book of Mormon that he left. It was a society of unity because there were no rich or poor among them. We have focused so much, brothers and sisters, on spirituality that we've forgotten the other half of that equation. For the early saints, there was no spirituality except in labor, except in work, except in temporal concerns. In the aspirations that Tricia read to you of the women in Bolivia, you'll notice their greatest aspiration was temporal, a better job, food for my family. There's something tangibly real about that, and something tangibly spiritual and scriptural about that that we've forgotten. In the church, we have a strong, rich-poor divide. We are the rich in most cases, and we've forgotten the poor. We have it here in the United States. We have it between us and members of the church outside the United States, but also in the countries of the third world is that divide. The church oftentimes looks for what they call leaders. Who are the leaders? The rich. I speak exaggeratedly and deliberately. They're not necessarily the jet setters, which the third world is filled with. But they're middle-class people who are well off. Compared, though, to the sea of poverty around them, they have a life raft that makes them rich. But the problem is that those leaders also don't comprehend the experience of the people around them. We need to dissolve that divide. There need not be rich or poor among us. And I dare say that that is an obligation. The church has left its temporal duty. It's doing very, very little. The church as an institution may not be able to. But what that means is that the church is more than an institution. It's more than 50 East North Temple. The church is the body of believers, namely us. So the obligation then falls on us to help. But helping is a double-edged sword. I said in my brief presentation that development has been tremendously damaging to women in Latin America. It's taken men away from communities, men away from households. It's worsened, in many cases, their abilities to provide health and food for their families. That kind of help, they don't need. What that means is that we have to learn to understand what we can really do. In some senses, this is the greatest issue of our time. It's a much greater issue than nuclear war, because this is the issue we have to live with, and it's the issue that divides our planet totally into a small group of spiritually blessed, temporally blessed, and a large group of impoverished.
Thanks for mentioning languages. I can't believe I forgot that. That's one of the things I usually get up on the soapbox about how many North Americans can't speak any other language besides English. At this point, we'd like to throw it open for questions or comments. And if you have a question that you would like to be addressed by a particular person, please let us know that.
The whispered answer was yes, there is a fence in the blonde-haired, blue-eyed Christ and the people around. But there's also an ideology in that. And many members of the church in the third world don't take offense at it because it reinforces a kind of implicit ideology in the church of superiority, of European superiority. That's an ideology that comes from colonialism. And unfortunately, we're perpetrating that in the confines of the church. And you find members who think that the United States is better, that the only way to live is the American way, that you're not going to get salvation if you're a man and don't wear a white shirt and a tie, or if you don't dress like a BYU sister, then, you know, you're not going to get salvation. We laugh because we know better. But nonetheless, those are kind of some of the implicit messages that are passed on there. They're unfortunate holdovers, and I think those are things we need to change.
I think we do need to give the Church Curriculum Committee, though, some credit for trying. I know that they have a developing countries curriculum now, and I'm not really familiar with all the different things, but they really are trying to diversify. And I think probably one of the problems is just as the gospel spreads, more needs become apparent, and I think that's what's going on. They do have some manuals that are simplified, and they're having some degree of success with that, but as in all things, it's a process to hit it right on the mark. One of the things I do know is that the welfare missionaries are the ones that go to a lot of these developing countries do have lessons that have people of all cultures in the materials, in all kinds of dress, and not one is listed or is used constantly as the model. And so I think that, you know, there are some strides being made in that way.
Back when I was in graduate school 10 years ago, I was in Latin American studies doing a little bit on liberation theology, and I guess the only comment I wanted to make was that I felt that at least an effort was being made, and I didn't see a comparable, I guess, feeling kind of effort being made, and it bothered me.
Just a little bit of historical background on liberation theory. It came out of a conference of the Vatican in 1964, and it wasn't until the early 70s that it became full force, especially in Central America, and that's where most of the success has been, in Nicaragua and Guatemala and such. And Nicaragua, the revolution and stuff, it's not all of the success of the Sandinista revolution. It's not because of the liberation theory, but many of the training of the rebels and stuff such were made through these base communities that were able to be leaders and to read and to discuss. And many times your definition of how you would interpret the Exodus would determine your political standpoint, and many, if you were Catholic, you were deemed as rebel, which is a 180 degree change from the past. So that's just a little bit of the background of it. David?
We're probably going to overwhelm every question because all of us want to talk about it, but I love liberation theology, and unfortunately it's become very heavily politicized. What that means is that it's not a neutral thing. Yes, the church, the Catholic Church, has been revitalized. It's taken on a tremendous dynamism. But it's also under attack from the Vatican and a lot of other pressures within the countries themselves. It's a very difficult process. But what has it meant? It's meant that there's a thrill about Christianity among poor people because they find their succor in the church. The church hears them, the church listens to them, and the church takes them seriously. Whereas the church used to be the refuge of the rich and the powerful. It used to be the thing that maintained the social structure. The priests and nuns, not the theologians. We talk about theology, we want to talk about Marxism, class conflict, all that stuff. That's icing. You know, that's the stuff that the formal intellectuals work on. Let's talk about the nuns and the priests who are out in the field. They're the ones who developed liberation theology. Many of them North Americans. Because they came across the poverty and they said, why? They read the gospel and they said, will a father give a stone to his child who asks for food? Then they turned around and took the scriptures and had the people read the scriptures. Do you know how revolutionary it is to read the scriptures? It is. They read the scriptures and did what Nephi said. They applied them to themselves. And out of that came revolution. It's not politically neutral. We're talking about an area that's riveted by political conflicts, where every ideology that most of us have cast off of the right and the left is still alive. And they're very powerful forces and bullets fly over them. But that gives greater life to the movement. I think, however, the unfortunate thing is that we as Mormons, because the Catholic Church has become so radicalized, that we as Mormons, along with other Protestants in Latin America, have moved to the right, politically and socially, because we're afraid of what we're hearing. We don't understand it. We hear it as North American Marxism, instead of hearing it as the message of Christ of loving your neighbor as yourself. And as a result, we fled from perhaps the greatest social movement of recent times. And I was going to cut there, but let me just say that what that means is that we're not converting the people we'd like to convert. Instead, we're converting people who are oftentimes from the right, who want to go back to a status quo that used to be in their minds, instead of the reality. They want to maintain social prestige and social status. What that means is the church gets firmly aligned with the right when their political movements were the ones to take the bombs. We're no longer politically neutral. We've made a stance, whether we like it or not. That's another place we members here in the United States might could help.
Well, I think we can help by talking about it, by contributing, by doing things, by showing the saints in Latin America that there is a room for social action in Mormonism, by being committed to development. You should see the legions of nuns and priests who go into the poor neighborhoods and form schools to teach children. The ideal is tremendous. These people are spiritual giants. They sacrifice a lot. But there's a lot we can do. It behooves us to get educated and contribute. We all can't go down and do that. We can also be involved firmly in studying the issue and in building development efforts, but also in doing political action here. What that means, I love politics, so I'm going to start getting a little radical. But what that means is that we ourselves have to write, we have to talk about it among ourselves and to our fellow members. We have to spread the good news of Christ and his message of salvation, temporal and spiritual. And if we do that to each other, the word will get back. We're the powerful ones. We're next door to 50 East North Temple. They're not. We want to change it. Change 50 East North Temple.
I just want to say, I think one of the problems is that for a lot of us, we go on a mission and we think we've done it. We're through. We've performed our service to the third world. And I think that a mission should be the start of an awareness, the start of the realization of how much we need to learn and how much we need to do. I'd like to respond. First of all, I think all that stuff about pre-existence is folklore and false and self-justifying, and that it gets in the way of our accomplishing what we need to do. And I think that there is a lot that can be done, and learning languages is an excellent place to start because you can do it right here. I forgot what else it was I was going to say.
I just wanted to give one example that we may think that what she's saying is just our attitude, but numerous occasions I was told by members down in Venezuela that you must have been so special in the pre-existence because you were born in the United States and you had this opportunity. So this, whether the folklore of it all has been ingrained into the members, and so I think many of them do even consider that to be the case.
But every hegemony has an alternative. And in this case, there are radical theologies within Mormonism that we need to revitalize and spread. Spread counter-folklore, revolutionary folklore, folks. Folklore of the world, unite.
I remembered what it was I wanted to say before, and that is that I think we really do have a lot to learn. We have truth, but we certainly don't have all of it. That's why there's supposed to be continuing revelation. And just really quick, one of my favorite scriptures And the day shall come to pass that the Jews shall have the records of the Nephites, and the Nephites shall have the records of the Jews, and the Nephites and the Jews shall have the words of the lost tribes of Israel, and the lost tribes of Israel shall have the words of the Nephites and the Jews. And there are a whole lot of words that we don't have yet, and I don't think we're open enough to receive those words, and I guess that's kind of what I'd like to see us willing to admit, that we don't know everything, and that there's maybe some really important things that we could learn from other people in other places.
I'd like to make a quick comment on learning. I think that we here have the opportunity to learn a lot of things. We have the full church structure. We have time to do things like this where we can talk about ideas and do extra reading and all that kind of, you know, we really have the luxury of doing all that. But I think that a lot of the saints in other cultures have learned more, can I say, about the quality of being a Christian and a follower of Christ, and have really internalized the, you know, the first two great commandments, to love the Lord and to love their fellow men. I think sometimes far beyond even our capacity to understand how much they have developed that in their lives. And I think there is a lot for us to learn about the very, very basics from watching the lives of some of these people.
The question was, what is the church doing specifically with regard to temporal matters to help people and members of the church in third world countries? And are there any general authorities who are sympathetic to the issues of third world members of the church?
Not close enough.
I just want to say something really quick about the placement program, since I've been familiar with that. There's been a lot of controversy. It's been in the papers. The Navajo tribe sued the church. They've raised the age. They're no longer taking children that are quite as young out of the homes. I think one of the issues there was that the choice was between getting a better education and not getting any of your cultural heritage, because the cultural stories were passed on in the wintertime, and then they went away. They didn't get any of that. And so people that went through placement, a lot of them lost touch and became sort of people without a country, you could say. They didn't know their Indian culture, and yet they were dark-skinned, and they couldn't relate really very well in either place sometimes. Although a lot of them did get better education and became better off that way. I think there is increasing sensitivity to the trade-off. I mean, it was perceived at first as we're doing a great thing by taking these Indian children into our homes, and I think now there is at least the recognition that maybe it wasn't all so great.
I think the history of the church helping in third world countries goes to the welfare services program. And for a long time, it was basically focused on the U.S. and developed countries. But I'd say in the last, since President Lee, there's been a real focus changing towards making sure that the saints all over the world had some care in their temporal affairs. One of the ways that it was started was through the welfare farms and all that were too sophisticated for most areas, and they started with the welfare services missionaries. And that has it's steadily climbing. There was a few years there where there was a real dip in the numbers, and they didn't quite know, the mission presidents didn't quite know how to use them, but I think they have been very helpful. A lot of the couples that are being called now are called as to go into areas where they can help with the temporal affairs, agriculture, teaching nutrition, those sorts of things. The church has a humanitarian service committee now. Since the fast for Ethiopia, there were a lot of extra funds, and they went into the humanitarian services fund. And they do have people in the welfare services department who are directly involved with dispersing those funds. And that, I think, is a major step for the church as far as caring for the poor of the world, is that they are taking some direct steps, and they're taking it in the usual church format, and that they're moving cautiously, but they're moving deliberately forward to help get involved, and they are working with some major organizations outside the church, other people who have had more years of experience in doing that. I'd say, and you ask who is involved, Bishop Pace was the head of welfare services for many years, and he has a very good feel for it. I know Marion D. Hanks served with the refugee program in Southeast Asia, and he's got a good feel for it. And one of the things I looked at while preparing these remarks was John Cormack. He gave a really outstanding talk with his wife at the last women's conference down at BYU. So I think there are quite a few. These are the ones that just come to mind. But there are quite a few general authorities who are very concerned about this whole issue and are very seriously considering it and seeing how the church can become more involved.
That's excellent. I was thinking about saying that, and I appreciate your saying that. There's the Mali Welisabugu Project. There is even, which Tricia is on, but even there's also the Indian Children's Foundation, who's being funded somewhat by the Welfare Services Committee to work in Bolivia, among other places, which I'm familiar with. And I saw Tim Evans back there. Maybe he could stand if he's still there, just so people know him. Tim is sort of the founder and director of the Indian Children's Foundation. So if you really want to be involved, you can talk to Tim. But that's still partial. The church is doing things now, but after quitting, used to be the church had an educational system in Bolivia. They gave that up. The people, and in Chile, and in Mexico, and a few other places, but the church gave it up. Members of the church have tried to form clinics where doctors who are members would volunteer time. Apostle Haight came down and said, we don't do that in the Mormon church. In other words, there's a group of doctors. Private members do. The problem is Bolivian private members are not allowed to. See, there's an interesting little thing here, which it gets rather complicated to explain. Because we can go down and do development, but we don't encourage them to deal for themselves sometimes, to develop their own resources. And what that leads to is a condition of dependency, which can be worse. And so there's a real careful balance. I mean, the solution is we need to learn. But the problem is that the church is new at this and just barely starting. I don't think the answer is from the church. I think the answer is that we as a people need to get involved. And when we get involved, then things will change. There's going to be a diversity of perspectives among us and a diversity of approaches because there is no golden key or golden road to development. And development may not even be a good goal in and of itself. That's questionable. But what that means is that, but the thing is, we need to be involved. And I think that just the changing of our own consciousness would work great wonders.
I think we all can.
I think I've got diarrhea of the comment or something. But what I wanted to say is I don't think tradition is bad. And your comment says that beautifully. Because generally we convert people away from their tradition. And what that means is we leave a vacuum. And the only thing that can flow in is this Anglo-Mormon culture. I mean, you spoke about the need to hold the core and let it be encapsulated in other people's cultures. It's a lovely metaphor. I wish we did it. Because we convert people away from the culture. The missionaries tell them, you can't do that. That's tradition. And if they don't tell them, the other members who've been around for a while will. And as a result, there's a tremendous disvaluing of tradition. But it surges up within the churches. And it would be helpful for people to know that it's okay to build the gospel in their own tradition. That it doesn't have to be the same way it was in the United States.
I've been asked to make one announcement, and that is, Fred Boros, do you still believe in magic? Why the 60th generation is losing faith will be redelivered at 6 in the amphitheater. Looks like that's it.